Hi, I'm Hub Arkush, and along with Eric Edholm, it is our pleasure to bring you this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly, where every week we bring you all the news, scoops, and rumors from around the NFL before they even happen.
We give grades to all 32 teams for their work in the recent NFL draft, and we give an update on the latest lockout news.
It's all just ahead on Pro Football Weekly.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air!
Thank you all for joining us for this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly. I am Hub Arkush, the publisher and editor, along with senior editor Eric Edholm, and we will be joined by the entire editorial staff of Pro Football Weekly over the course of the next hour, bringing you up to date on everything that is happening in the National Football League. And Eric, we start, we'd like to be able to update people more than we can on where things are at with the 8th District Appellate Court in St. Louis. At a temporary injunction was issued a week ago Friday during the second round of the draft with the specific language that it was only until Monday so that the judges on the three-judge panel could have more time to review the evidence. One of those three judges issued a scathing disagreement with it and said he doesn't understand why they need time. There shouldn't be a stay at all. But we were led to believe maybe we'd find out something on Monday. Monday turned into Tuesday, and then finally the clerk at the court said on Wednesday that something was happening any minute. By Thursday there would be a decision. Well, as we sit here taping at the end of the week, we wait. And the ramifications of it, I think, are pretty clear. If the judges decide to leave the stay in place, in effect overturning Judge Susan Nelson's ruling that the lockout should be lifted, it is not only a big win for the owners in terms of pursuing their strategy, it's a huge loss for the players, and quite frankly, it's a big loss for the fans.
Yeah, I think the players, after that initial Nelson ruling, kind of felt like, hey, you know, we've gotten the first big victory in this thing, at least in terms of court is concerned. But Yeah, I'm with you. I'm surprised that it's taken this long to get to this point. I mean, we expected something to be ruled permanently here in this past week, but I've had many conversations with Michael Gans, the court clerk there, and nothing appears imminent. The good news, Hub, of course, is that they have given an expedited court date for this thing, and June 3rd is the date. I also talked to Mr. Gans, who told me that it's not the 30 to 45 day timetable that many people expected. This could be a 15-day thing. This could be a lot quicker than your typical case. So there is some optimism on the time frame, at least.
Well, yeah, and I guess that's good news. But I think just to try and eliminate some of the confusion that may exist here, because there's a bunch of different things going on in court. The NFL players went to the 8th District in Minneapolis in Judge Nelson's court to file an antitrust suit against the National Football League. Nothing is happening with that suit. That is not relevant to any of the rulings that we're waiting on right now. They also filed a motion to have an injunction put in place to stay, or not to stay, but to keep the NFL owners from locking the players out. Said that they can't do it. We have valid contracts. We're not a union. There's no basis for it. That is the rulings that we're looking for now. Judge Nelson agreed with the players. She granted the injunction. The owners then appealed to her asking for a stay of her ruling until they could get to the appellate court, and she said no. And she said the burden of proof here is there compelling damage that is being done to the plaintiff by leaving the lockout in place? She said clearly there is, and so she wants the lockout lifted. They then got this three-judge panel in the appellate court to grant the temporary stay after the lockout had been lifted. It had been lifted for, well, technically it had been lifted for 3 days, but the owners had actually welcomed the players in that Friday morning. They granted the temporary stay. All that we're waiting for this three-judge panel to rule on now is whether the stay remains in place until the June 3rd trial date that they've set, in which case there will be a lockout until June 3rd, or if they're going to agree with Judge Nelson and say, no, the lockout has to be lifted right away. None of this has anything to do with the antitrust case. It has a great deal to do with whether the owners can lock the players out or not. And quite frankly, that's all that matters right now, because if the judges remove the lockout, if they say you got to let these guys come to work, then the owners are going to have to start some period of free agency, and then fans are going to have something to follow and feel good about, because we'll know what teams these guys are going to be on this year.
Yeah, I think that's an important distinction to make, is that I think there will be some distractions from all the labor mess if players are able to be traded, if free agents are able to move. Obviously, it may not be quite the bonanza we're expecting. If we go by last year's rules, only 6-year free agents and higher, guys with more than 6 accrued seasons in the NFL, are going to be free. It affects, obviously, the restricted free agents, all the franchise tags that the teams placed on these players before this lockout was enacted. So, you know, there's a lot going on right now. My question, though, is that if these three judges initially ruled on something, what's going to make them change their mind? Perhaps that one judge could you know, compel the other two to change their mind on the stay.
Well, but again, this is where all the confusion comes from, is we were told that it was nothing but a temporary stay to allow the judges to consider all the evidence. One of the three judges said, I've seen enough evidence, this is silly. The other two said nothing. And so basically you can argue this both way. You could say, hey, the owners need both votes, the players only need one, because we know this one judge isn't going to change his mind. But I think the even better question is, if they're willing to leave this lockout in place indefinitely till they get to the hearing, what's going to happen to the hearing for them to say, well, but now we think the lockout's a bad thing and force them to lift it? You almost have a sense that these two judges are tipping their hands. We don't support either side legally, folks, at Pro Football Weekly. This is up to the judges and the lawyers to decide. The point that I think we're talking about here, though, is that you need to understand, at whatever point the lockout is lifted, whether it's done by the courts or whether it's done because there is some compromise, there's a settlement of the lawsuit and then a recertification of the union and a new CBA, at whatever point, there's going to have to be some fixed period of free agency that begins for players to find teams and get signed. Even if the court case goes in favor of the players and it gets lifted, and that takes, let's say, 3 weeks, you're almost at July 1st. You still need 4 weeks of free agency. Training camps are not going to open on time. We're already at that point. Our focus at Pro Football Weekly is helping you all understand what the impact is of this on the 2011 NFL season. It's not to take sides one way or the other.
Right, and we should remind people that scenario you just brought up of possible negotiations toward a new CBA. They do have mediated sessions scheduled for May 16th and May 17th back up in Minnesota. So that is a good thing. Now, if we're going to look at the recent trend of mediated session, there didn't appear to be a lot of progress, at least not what we could gather. So it's got to be taken with a grain of salt here, too.
Well, and the reason that both sides agreed to that May 16th date is I believe there's either a May 12th or May 13th date where Judge David Doty is scheduled to rule on damages for the players who've already won their suit against the owners for acting improperly in the negotiation of TV contracts in 2008. Now, both sides want to know, what if Doty comes in and gives the players $1 billion,
yeah,
or half $1 billion, or a couple hundred million, whatever the number may be? That certainly has a huge impact on all this as well. Conversely, if he says, you know what, the owners are guilty, but there was no damages or damages were minimal, we're going to give you $20, well, then the whole thing's a lot of smoke, and that doesn't help the players at all, other than possibly in their antitrust case down the road.
Yeah, I have a feeling that if there's severe damages are awarded, the NFL may change its tune or certainly speed things up in terms of negotiation process.
Folks, we apologize if this is confusing to you all, but we suggest the way it's going right now, nobody's more confused than the owners and the players. They don't seem to know what they're doing. We hope they'll get their act straight soon, as well as the appellate court. In the meantime, we've got some football talk coming up for you next. We're back with more Pro Football Weekly, and we actually had an NFL college draft this past week, a little player movement, some football to talk about. So let's do it. We welcome in senior editor Mike Wilkany, who covers the AFC North. And story in Baltimore, Mike. Ozzie Newsome, in a conference call with season ticket holders earlier this week, said it's time for quarterback Joe Flacco to take ownership of the offense in his fourth NFL season. What exactly do you mean by that?
I think it speaks to the feeling that this is an offense that needs to take a step forward. And if that's going to happen, Joe Flacco, just by the natural maturation process, that passing game taking a step forward, that would be what would carry this forward. And I don't think there's been any argument that Joe Flacco has played well at times in his first three seasons, and he's done some nice things. And, you know, Ozzie Newsome in that conference call, with ticket holders, brought up a couple games where he played well. That Pittsburgh game, that Atlanta game where he led comebacks. I was at that Falcons game in Atlanta. The Ravens looked like a legitimate Super Bowl team in the second half of that game, and it was because Joe Flacco and that passing game took a step forward. I think what he was saying in this conference call to ticket holders was, look, you know, if this is going to be an offense that's going to take a step forward, then Flacco takes the step forward. And Newsom expressed confidence that he's ready to do that and ready for this to sort of for him to put his stamp on this offense, so to speak.
Well, Mike, you know, I mean, Joe Flacco is a free agent coming up. He wants a long-term deal. It doesn't affect this season, but if Joe Flacco plays at the same level he has over the past 2 years, let's say, does this mean the Ravens might move on from him, that they might make alternate plans in the future for their starting quarterback?
I don't think so. I think really Joe Flacco will be a guy that they put their trust in and make the centerpiece of that offense for the foreseeable future. As you know, not easy to find quarterbacks. He has played well. I think he's an upper half of the league quarterback at this point of his career. Where he stacks among the game's quarterbacks is open to debate. He clearly can take a step forward here with even better play this season, but I don't think they want to back away from Joe Flacco just yet, unless he were to regress significantly. And I don't think that's going to happen. I think he's still on the uptick, but again, it's how far will he go? How far will this team go? Again, just that one Super Bowl appearance and win in franchise history for a team that has ranked amongst the AFC's best teams for some time.
All right, Mike, very quickly, let's talk about the Pittsburgh Steelers. What are they going to do with Rashard Mendenhall? Mendenhall has now issued a, quote, clarification of his controversial tweets about Osama bin Laden. His clarification suggests to me that he still doesn't get that he was stupid and he was wrong. You know, it's not that he's trying to defend it. He says, of course, I understand how horrible the acts were. But this is a classic case of somebody who doesn't seem to be that bright trying to tell you that he's a genius and nobody else gets it. And I wonder how the Pittsburgh Steelers feel about it.
Well, Art Rooney, in a statement, said that he wasn't entirely clear where Rashard Mendenhall was coming from because he hadn't spoken to Mendenhall. And in that statement, Rooney expressed support for the troops and in the mission. And from the Steelers' standpoint, you hope it blows over. You hope you can go on with it. Rashard Mendenhall is, you know, a top 10, top 12 running back in this league. I don't think you necessarily want to give up on someone for maybe some remarks that didn't go over particularly well with a lot of folks. He's still a very talented guy. And I think, as you mentioned, a young guy. And I think, you know, this obviously was something where there are people that probably don't look at him in the same light at this point going forward. That's sort of an unfortunate situation, all things considered.
All right, Mike, thank you very much. We're going to hand it off now to Associate Editor Dan Parr. And, Dan, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, some people feel, had either the best or the worst draft in the NFL, depending on the health of their first two picks, and particularly their second pick, Daquan Bowers, got arguably the best player in the draft with the 51st overall pick because of a knee that nobody but the Bucs seems to trust. And now GM Mark Domenech is admitting not planning surgery. He is going to have to be coddled, but apparently they think they can get enough out of him to justify the pick.
And this move by the Bucs taking Bowers in the second round wasn't something that just hatched at the last moment. Going into the second round, Mark Domenech knew that if he was waiting for them at number 51, they were going to take him, and he pulled the trigger, knowing that whatever the doctors had seen, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers doctors had seen with Bowers, it gave him the confidence to think that they can manage this knee situation and that he could come in and perform it and probably surprise people right away. They think that he could be a starter for them at the left-end position. They took Adrian Claiborne. He could be starting at the right-end position. With those two guys, and Gerald McCoy and Brian Price, the two top two picks from a year ago playing defensive tackle, they really feel like they have the young pieces in place for this line to become a great one in the not-too-distant future.
Well, Dan, the team that finished behind the Falcons in the division race last year, the New Orleans Saints, you could argue made some of the biggest, boldest moves in the draft, including trading a future first-round pick for Mark Ingram, the former Heisman Trophy Award-winning running back, a move that was praised by a lot of people, one of whom wasn't Reggie Bush. Obviously, he's questioned his own role in the team. I know Drew Brees contacted him shortly after. What's the plan for Bush? Can they afford to keep him? Is there going to have to be a salary reduction? Where do you see him possibly fitting in New Orleans or perhaps somewhere else?
There's absolutely going to have to be a salary reduction for him to stay with the Saints. He's due to make $11.8 million in 2011. It's been known for some time that pay cut is going to be essential for him if he's going to stay with the Saints. The Saints have a plan for him. Sean Payton made it clear that, you know, he also reached out to Reggie Bush and said, there's a plan for him to be a part of the offense next year. They took Ingram thinking Reggie Bush would still be there, but they do have the flexibility now where if Bush's pride, you could say, gets in the way, they have enough guys with Mark Ingram, Pierre Thomas, Chris Ivory to go forward with that backfield and be okay. But, you know, Reggie Bush is going to have to make a decision. Does he think his value is greater on the open market than it is taking a pay cut with the Saints? It's pretty much in his hands.
All right, Dan, thank you very much. We've got to take another quick commercial break, but we've got lots more NFL Way We Hear It coming up right after these commercial words. Welcome back to the program. Hub Arkush and Eric Edholm in studio. We are joined on the hotline by executive editor Dan Arkush. And Dan's got the NFC West clubs amongst the teams that he covers for Pro Football Weekly. And Dan, a lot of people around the NFL scratching their heads a little bit. The second night of the draft, the Cardinals got as close to a sure thing, I think, as you're going to get in Patrick Peterson, the cornerback, with the fifth pick in the first round. But then they come back in the second round and draft what most people felt was the second best running back on the board, Ryan Williams of Virginia Tech. It's always nice to get the second best running back in the second round, but what are the Cardinals going to do with him?
It's a great question, Hub. They have Beanie Wells, who is a former first round pick just a couple of years ago. Tim Hightower, a dual-threat running back who's been really good for them for the most part, and a third-down back in Lerod Stevens-Holling. You know, not all these guys are going to be able to play. I mean, they drafted this high for Williams, so something's got to give here, and nobody really knows exactly what.
The NFC West, Dan, has become sort of the quarterback-starved division, rather, and, you know, the Cardinals have their own questions. But what about the Seahawks? You know, there was some thought that they would either acquire a veteran, the lockout prevented that, or draft a quarterback somewhere along the way. They didn't do that this past weekend. Matt Hasselbeck, now is he back in the picture? Can you talk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, I think he is, Eric. You know, for a while there, it was looking like they had reached an impasse with him on the possibility of a new deal. But I think with every, you know, with this downtime now, Hasselbeck has really come to realize just how entrenched he and his family are in Seattle. And I think there's a quality of life factor that might be coming into play. And so he very much is still in the running there.
Interesting, though, Dan, they got to pay Charlie Whitehurst $4 million, and they didn't draft a quarterback, and I think everybody thought they would, at least in the middle rounds, if not up high.
Right, and that $4 million tag on Charlie Whitehurst is a big reason why many think they'll probably maybe cut the cord with Hasselbeck. John Schneider is saying that Whitehurst right now is a 50-50 possibility, so there's just a lot of fluidity out there, and there's still the very real possibility of a veteran like Kevin Kolb or somebody else via free agency or trade coming in there.
All right, Dan, thank you very much. Eric, I want to talk to you about one of your ball clubs now, the Dallas Cowboys. And Dez Bryant was supposed to show up at the Cowboys facility on Friday in that tiny little window where the lockout had been lifted. It told Jerry Jones he'd come in and talk about how the surgery had gone and maybe visit a little bit about some of the offseason stupidity he'd been involved in. And he was a no-show, and so the owner wasn't very happy. Then Tony Romo organizes workouts and gets as many as 40 veterans to show up. And the first day, again, no Dez Bryant. But Bryant does show up the second day. And according to Romo, Bryant had been clear with him that he had a family issue on the first day, couldn't make it, but that he would be there day two as he was and at all other subsequent workouts. Interesting to me, though, that given the opportunity to go talk to the boss, Bryant didn't think it was important enough. It seems like this drama is going to continue for a while.
Do we need to get this guy on the show or what? I would love to do like a 12-minute segment with Dez Bryant just to get his side of the story and everything. But, yeah, I mean, the reporters are going to be lined up, and certainly Jerry Jones wants to get to him first whenever he does speak with the media. But I guess it's a good sign he was there for the second day. And who knows really how much can come out of these workouts. It's good to get everybody on the same page. I think Tony Romo wants to throw coming off that collarbone injury. Bryant clearly could be something special in Dallas if he wants to. But right now there's a disconnect between players, between Bryant, and between the ownership. And so this lockout certainly hasn't helped him.
Well, and I think most importantly for the Dallas Cowboys, probably the most significant part of this is that it is Tony Romo who is the standard bearer here. He's gotten some help from Jason Witten, but this is a guy who's been criticized for his leadership from day one, and he clearly is taking the bull by the horns here, saying this is my team, at least it's my offense, and I'm going to make sure that we're doing everything that we should be doing as we try and weather this lockout.
Yeah, I don't know how many times I've said it, but this is a crucial year for Tony. I mean, I feel like I've echoed that sentiment the last 3 or 4 years, so you know, we'll see how it turns out. I mean, I think Tony really realizes that, you know, the Cowboys could go in a different direction if things don't work out this year, and there's some expectations there.
All right, we're going to take another quick commercial break here, guys, but we've got to talk about the AFC South. We've also got the AFC East, and we're going to give you our draft analysis, grades on every team. It's all just ahead.
All Weekly is on the air.
Yes, we are. We are breaking down the 2011 NFL College Draft, the 76th annual player lottery since, as the history reports, George Halas had the idea of saying, let's spread the wealth around and have a draft. It is the subject of some of the antitrust violations the league is currently trying to deal with. It's something that every major sport has, and we have to assume that it will continue in the NFL. But this was the last one that was guaranteed by the old collective bargaining agreement. In Houston, they took full advantage. Arthur, I love what the Houston Texans did with those first three picks. I mean, you know, you knew they had to punch up the defense, and they got, I think, maybe three guys who step in and start right away, and they've got Wade Phillips there to try and teach them all how to play his new 3-4 scheme.
Yeah, a lot of exciting things going on in Houston. Wade Phillips, as you probably already know, has an amazing track record in his first year as a defensive coordinator. He's taken each of his last four gigs to the playoffs in the first season after they missed out the year before he arrived. So there's a lot of things to be excited about. And as you mentioned, you look at J.J. Watt and Brooks Reed, Brandon Harris. They did some nice things, some kids that can come in and play right away. So it's really a matter of where they all fit in and how quickly they can make that adjustment.
You know, one of those people fitting in, and obviously sort of the centerpiece of this defense along with Brian Cushing, is Mario Williams. And Mario has been a 4-3 end. He's rushed from the weak side his entire NFL career. And yet it sounds like Wade Phillips has some very interesting plans for him.
That's correct. We know Phillips had a great deal of success working with DeMarcus Ware down in Dallas, and apparently he's going to try and get the same thing going with Mario Williams in Houston. He envisions Williams as a 3-4 weak side outside linebacker on rundown. So on first and second down, you'll see him standing up and trying to get after the rusher, and then on third down, he's going to put his hand down and really try and wreak havoc in the backfield.
You know, it's interesting, guys. Connor Barwin was looking like the real deal before he broke that leg. Assuming that he's completely healthy, you could be looking at a linebacking core of Mario Williams, Brian Cushing, D'Amico Ryans, and Connor Barwin. That's going to match any 3-4 set in the league and could be devastating. Again, Arthur, the key is when does Phillips get his hands on these kids? We've talked about some of the rookie head coaches. This is a situation where a new coordinator is suffering as much as those rookie head coaches not being able to work with his players.
Well, absolutely. Phillips has a somewhat complex odd front, and when you're talking about that 3-4 scheme in terms of the defensive linemen, there's still going to be one-gap guys. There's not going to be a whole lot of changes for them, but when you get to the second level and you start talking about the linebackers, there's more for them. You know, there's more on their plate, and they're fortunate, as you mentioned, to have so much talent, especially on the inside, Cushing and Ryans. These are guys that are going to work in any system. But, you know, some of the young guys making the transition with a limited time constraint given the lockout, it could be more difficult.
All right, Arthur, thank you very much. We're going to have you hand the mic off to Associate Editor Kevin Fishbane, and Kevin's got the AFC East. Kevin, two of your clubs, the Buffalo Bills and the Miami Dolphins, with Ryan Fitzpatrick and Chad Henne as their starting quarterbacks. A lot of folks thought both teams would be in the market for a quarterback. Both teams said not a priority, and then backed it up by not taking a quarterback. The Bills, in particular, putting a lot of stock in Ryan Fitzpatrick as they focus on rebuilding that defense.
Yeah, the Bills had a lot of opportunities. You look at the third pick, they could have taken Blaine Gabbert. They went with Marcell Dareus, who, you know, their defense was just miserable last year, especially against the run, so that'll be an immediate help, but they liked Blaine Gabbert. Then you get to the second round, they had Andy Dalton or Colin Kaepernick, and Chan Gailey coached Dalton, the Senior Bowl, so there's a connection right there. Still, in the third round, they had a chance at Ricky Stanzi if they wanted him when they had their pick come up then. So, again, they continued to ignore the quarterback position. But Nix did say they don't have any backups right now, technically on the roster, behind Fitzpatrick, so they will go get someone. But it is interesting they put how much confidence they put behind him, not get anyone in the draft, really just putting all the focus on fixing that defense.
And let's make this point. It is Buddy Nix's draft. I mean, since he became the general manager, he obviously had a background in college scouting. It kind of pushed Tom Modrak, a guy who's been in the organization since 2001, kind of pushed him to the margin. So it was no shock that he was let go a couple days after the draft.
No, it wasn't. I think the timing was a little interesting. I mean, I watched Buddy Nix and Modrak sit together and give their pre-draft press conference. So it was a little strange to see that. But yeah, you know, a lot of people associate Modrak with the drafting of Aaron Maben, which has really just never panned out for the Bills. And you're right, you know, it's Buddy's team now. Buddy makes the decisions, and that's just the route they decided to go with the personnel.
Kevin, let me ask you very quickly. The Miami Dolphins, obviously in the market for a running back, did a nice job trading up to get Daniel Thomas. Looks like Ronnie Brown and Ricky Williams will both be gone. We know they have an interest in D'Angelo Williams, who would be a restricted free agent under the 2010 rules, unrestricted under prior rules. But as we wait for all that to play out, How did the Dolphins not at least bring in a quarterback? I mean, you have to assume that Chad Pennington is done, and in the start he got against the Bears last year out of necessity, Tyler Thigpen certainly showed he can't play it. You know, it's one thing to have faith in Chad Henne. It's another thing to have nobody else besides him on the roster.
Right, that's true. And again, similar to the Bills, they just don't have a backup right now. But the Dolphins did not have the luxury that the Bills had. The Dolphins didn't have a lot of picks to work with. They didn't have the second-round pick because of the Brandon Marshall trade. They traded three picks to get Daniel Thomas, and they really needed a running back first and foremost, because they just don't have anybody right now. They needed to shore up the interior line, which is why they got Mike Pouncey. And then at that point, you know, again, they just did not have enough picks, and there weren't enough quarterbacks to get someone. You know, they're going to get someone when free agency starts. They're going to bring in a veteran to challenge Chad Henne, but they're at least improving the weapons around him, and improving that offensive line should help him a little bit. He showed some flashes last season. Definitely not in the fourth quarter, but every quarter before that, he definitely showed some flashes. So they're going to keep that confidence in him.
All right, Kevin, thank you very much. Guys, we've got to take another commercial break, but it's time to grade them all. Nolan Narok, he's the best in the business with the NFL draft. We'll get our grades on all 32 teams right after this commercial break. Back with more Pro Football Weekly, and it is time to get your pencils and scorecards out. We've got grades on all 32 NFL teams. Nolan Narocki, our senior editor and the author of the Pro Football Weekly Draft Preview book, the best independent talent analyst out there, no question about that. Kicked butt again with his mock draft. He actually matched up 12 players with the correct teams, had the first round nailed. And Nolan, let's take a look at these NFL clubs now and see how they did. We'll start with the AFC North. And I can see that you're pretty impressed with the Cleveland Browns and the Baltimore Ravens.
Yeah, I thought the Browns really did a good job, you know, throughout that draft, but especially getting the first-round pick next year. I think they came away from that trade with Atlanta with a bevy of picks that will really help them build that roster. I like Phil Taylor at nose tackle, Jabal Sheard, and Greg Little. I think the three of them could become starters. They did take some risk there with the character, but I think all of them could be managed in that defense.
Nolan, as we transition to the AFC South, you know, it was an interesting draft for all four teams because Tennessee and Jacksonville addressed their quarterback issues. Jake Locker going eighth, Gabbert 10th to the Jaguars. In 2 years or 3 years or 4 years, who do you think is going to have the best draft of this group, and who did you like?
I really like what Houston did with J.J. Watt in the first round, Brooks Reed in the second, and then following back up, coming up and trading for Brandon Harris. I think they landed three solid starters that really fit that defense and will help Wade Phillips get it on the right track.
All right, so let's summarize here now through the first two. The Cleveland Browns with an A, the Baltimore Ravens, and Houston Texans with A minuses. B-plus for the Cincinnati Bengals and the Indianapolis Colts. You've got a B for the Tennessee Titans, and Pittsburgh and Jacksonville each get a C-plus. Now we move to the AFC East. Boy, nobody plays this thing like Bill Belichick does. You've got an A for him again, and then Bs for all three of the other clubs, Miami, the Jets, and Buffalo.
Yeah, what Bill Belichick really does well is manipulate the draft board. He moves up and down and knows when to select that value. And I think he did an excellent job again this year. Wound up with an additional first and second round pick in next year's draft. And you got to look at some of the picks that he dealt away. I think he came away with some value there as well. Added Deion Branch and some solid veterans for draft picks that they gave up during the season. So, you know, you look at their picks, Nate Solder, Razai Dowling, and Shane Vereen. I think all three of them will come in and have solid roles. I'm a little surprised they passed on Anthony Costanzo and Aaron Williams. But, you know, you look at Ryan Mallett and Marcus Cannon, and I think they got some potential value down the road as well.
Looking at your grades for the AFC West, Nolan, you've got an A-minus for Kansas City. Obviously took some interesting risks in the draft, but did a nice job collecting talent. Denver, a B. They got Von Miller, the guy at number two. Had a pretty solid draft thereafter. But I'm interested in hearing your thoughts on Oakland and San Diego, who got your two lowest grades in the AFC, both tied with a C. Tell me what you did not like about those two teams' drafts.
With Oakland, I think they've reached on a lot of players that have speed and explosiveness, but they just don't show up real well on tape. DeMarcus Van Dyke in the third, Joseph Barksdale, their other third-round pick, and even Chimney Checkwin in the fourth. I thought all of them have the measurables, but you know they just don't show up on tape enough, and I think it's going to take some time to develop them. In San Diego, I was really surprised by Jonas Mooten in the second round. I thought it was probably the greatest reach in this year's draft. I thought it was way too early to pull him off the board, and you know, you look at the inside linebacker class, there wasn't a lot of depth there, so I think a number of teams reached on inside linebackers.
All right, but let's flip it around, though, and look at the Kansas City Chiefs, who you're giving an A-minus to, and I'm sure that's for the body of work. I know in the first round, I like the Jonathan Baldwin pick, particularly paired with Dwayne Bowe, and yet I know he's a guy that you had a little bit outside the first round. I mean, you're not far off where he was drafted. So I'm assuming it's as much the depth as that first pick that you like in Kansas City.
Yeah, I wasn't a big fan of the Baldwin pick, but, you know, he did have the measurables, you know, with a guy like Todd Haley, who's got a track record working with receivers. I think it may have been worth the risk at that spot. You look at Rodney Hudson in the second round. I think he could be a 12-year starter if he stays healthy. Justin Houston, if they can manage him right, could be a good value pick in the third round. And I like Alan Bailey as well. I thought he's a guy that really fits their defense and has eventual starter potential as well.
All right, Nolan, thank you very much. I want you to hold on for a minute. That is the AFC in the books. We're going to take a look at the NFC. Grade every club in the senior circuit right after this very quick commercial break. Welcome back to Pro Football Weekly as we put final grades on drafting in the 2011 NFL College Draft. Now, to be clear, we won't really analyze this draft or put the grades that matter on it for 2 years, but we're talking now just about teams that got value with their picks, that were able to trade and get other assets, teams that we think did the right things. Now, Nolan has a bit of a scale that he works off of, and this is not etched in stone, but any team that gets four projected starters out of the draft or with veterans that they traded for and gave up draft picks for them gets an A, three starters to be rated good, two would be average, a C, one gets you a D, and if you haven't got anybody who's going to start, you're going to get yourself an F. Now, there's no Fs on this. As a matter of fact, no Ds right now. It looks like everybody at least has a chance to have two players to start. Nolan, let's look at the NFC North. Chicago Bears actually got the best grade in that division from you with a B. You got a B minus on the Packers and C's for the Lions in Minnesota. Some folks like the Detroit Lions draft. What's your problem there?
You look at last year's draft, I think you look at Javid Best. At the beginning of the year, I think he was an impact player, and by the end of the year, he was looking for a soft landing spot, somewhere to hide. And with their second-round pick, Titus Young, I think they got a similar guy, 174-pounder. I got serious questions about his durability and his immaturity. I think there's some risk there. You look at the first-round pick with Nick Fairley, I think he's a classic boomer-bust pick. Could be an A, could be a D, but could go either way. And they traded up for Mikel LeShore, who... personally, the instincts, the competitiveness, the vision, I think those are all prime criteria for the running back position. I don't think he grades out highly in any area. So, you know, in 3 years, we'll see where this draft is. I just have serious questions about what they came away with in the first two rounds.
Well, knowing the NFC South certainly didn't lack for intrigue. You had the New Orleans Saints moving up into the first round, getting Mark Ingram. We talked to Dan Parr about that earlier. Cameron Jordan, their other pick. Tampa Bay taking a free-falling Daquan Bowers. That was a big news. Cam Newton with the number one pick. You know, obviously a huge story down in Carolina. And then you've got Atlanta, and they made this big bold move up for Julio Jones. They also traded up later for Jacquizz Rodgers. And yet you give them a C+, your lowest grade in the NFC South. Talk me through that rationale a little bit.
Well, it was really a result of the formula. When you look at the starters, I think you got to count future picks as potential starters, and they gave away a first-round pick next year as well as a first this year and just a load of picks, and I think that really pushed down the grade overall. As far as the players they came away with, I really liked what they did. I thought Julio Jones, I think he's a guy that can come in right away and make an immediate impact. As long as he can stay healthy, he's a guy that will make a difference for their offense. You got Akeem Dent in the third, who I thought was a very solid pick. I like Jacquizz Rodgers in the fifth, and I think the punter is going to come in the sixth round and help him out right away. And, you know, even their seventh-round picks I thought were solid. So I think they did a very good job of drafting where there were picks, but you know, just giving away so much, I think pushes down the grade.
Nolan, in the NFC East, A's are awfully hard to come by, but you give one to the New York Giants, a B for the Redskins, a B minus for the Cowboys, and a C plus for the Eagles. What excited you so much about the Giants' work?
I think the first four picks all brought very solid value. To get Prince Amukamara at the 19th slot, I thought was a great value pick. You know, for their the quality of their coaching staff, I thought it was worth taking the risk on a guy like Marvin Austin, who has first-round talent, and I think he's a guy that could get molded there. So I like the first two picks. Jarrell Jernigan, I think, is a guy that can contribute in a return game, help him out in the slot, maybe replace Steve Smith if he leaves in free agency. So, you know, I think they got value throughout the draft, round 6 through 7. They had 4 picks. I think all 4 of them will help him on a special team. So I just liked the way they upgraded their roster.
No, in the NFC West, obviously a much maligned division, given the fact that a Seahawks team barely snuck into the playoffs last year. You gave them the lowest draft in the NFL for this year's draft, the lowest grade, I should say. They upgraded the offensive line, certainly in need, but what didn't they do that that would have raised their grade a little bit?
I just didn't see a lot of value throughout this draft. I thought they reached just about with every pick, and I don't think they came away with a whole lot. James Carpenter was going to go 32nd to the Packers. That was the guy that they had their eyes on. So, you know, maybe it wasn't that great of a reach relatively, but, you know, I have concerns about whether he's going to be able to plug in and just what he's going to bring. John Moffitt could be a functional starter in the league, but, you know, it's not a flashy pick. And, you know, you look at rounds 4 through 7, I just don't think they came away with a lot. You know, some of those guys do fit their scheme. Richard Sherman's a big press corner, and the same with Byron Maxwell in the 6th. You know, they really fit what Pete Carroll does. I just wasn't impressed with what they came away with.
And Nolan, one last question on the NFC West. The Rams, one of those teams that could be on the verge of making a splash. You really like their draft. You gave it an A. A lot of people clamoring for a receiver. They didn't get their wideouts till rounds 3 and 4, but you think they might be guys who contribute right away.
Yeah, Austin Pettis and Greg Salas, I think they're both very dependable, sure-handed receivers. I think they're going to be assets for Sam Bradford and really help Josh McDaniels establish that offense.
B pluses for the Niners in Arizona. One thing I've got to ask you about, Nolan, the botched trade between the Bears and the Ravens. I thought Ozzie Newsome took the high ground. I thought Jerry Angelo embarrassed himself by not voluntarily giving back the compensation. I thought Roger Goodell embarrassed himself by not making him, coming out and saying he thought the Bears should compensate, but he was going to leave it up to them. What is the blowback on the Bears and Jerry Angelo in the front office community, if any at all, from this?
Well, I know they were calling around trying to make trades at one point on the second day of the draft, and they were having a hard time finding takers. They did strike one deal, but a lot of teams were turned off by it, and I think just the way they bumbled through that situation spoke very negatively on the front office in general.
All right, Nolan, thank you very much. Nolan's going to go sleep for a month now, folks, because he hasn't slept for the last month.
Enjoy.
Great job again this season. We're going to take one more commercial break, and then we're back with the Publisher's Cup.
And now with the Publisher's Pen, the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkish.
Eric, thank you very much, and I actually wanted to comment on a story that you have done for ProFootballWeekly.com. It's something I've been keeping a close eye on for the last couple of months, as you all know, that the NFL owners themselves have imposed this lockout on the players. It means there can be no contact between coaches or front office and any players or prospective players in the league. We now have confirmation from at least 6 different NFL agents that they were receiving calls about players they represented to be signed as priority free agents from various NFL teams. We've also heard rumblings of NFL teams talking to the agents for veteran players, trying to get a head start on free agency. Now, Greg Aiello, speaking for the league, confirmed for Pro Football Weekly that there should be no contact, that there will be penalties if there is. We know that there were 5 teams that were fined shortly after the lockout was instituted for illegal contact with players. Anybody who believes that these teams are sitting around just waiting, not doing anything, taking chances on free agency, is kidding themselves, and that's just one more reason this lockout has to stop. It is creating an unbalanced playing field. The NFL can claim they're monitoring it, but apparently they're not. That's going to do it for this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly. Our thanks to Randy Meyer, our producer and engineer, Syndication Networks, our home studio, and most of all, our thanks to all of you for listening. Come back again next week, same time, same station, for more Pro Football Weekly.